Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Greater New York Hospital Association and United Hospital Fund Quality Initiative. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, we will conduct a question-and-answer session, and instructions will follow at that time. If anyone should require audio assistance during the conference, please press star then zero to reach an operator. I would now like to hand the call over to Terry Straub.
Hi, good afternoon, and thanks again for everyone joining the call. We have quite a number of people on the call today, and I think that's great given it's the middle of a hot July day and we're sweltering here. The start is today. Just wanted to let you know the hospital speaking will be the Mount Sinai Hospital, and they have most graciously agreed to talk for about 10, 15 minutes on their initiative, what successes they have had and what barriers they still are facing. And we'll follow by Dr. Richard Shannon talking about jugular versus subclavian placement, the use of the biopatch, and then return on investment. We don't want to spend too much time on the clinical issues, but there have been quite a number of questions among all the participants. It seems to be one of the major struggles or barriers to moving the project forward. On the side of putting components for the kit together, Greater New York has been reviewing quite a number of different proposals from vendors.
Hello? Hi, Terry. It's Rick Shannon. Sorry to be a moment late.
Oh, no problem. I'm just going through introductions, Dr. Shannon.
Okay.
So we put together the different proposals for the bundle. We'll be reaching out to some hospitals now just to see if this is exactly what you're looking for. And we have managed to get some very good pricing for these services. So we will be sharing all of that with you as it becomes available. Secondly, I just want to apologize on behalf of Greater New York and United Hospital Fund with doing this project, because it's come to our attention after we put together the second meeting on October 19th that it's also an APIC meeting. And we have done everything in our power to try to switch that meeting, but the speakers have already booked the time, and it's a rather expensive switch for the grant if we were to change it now. And Mr. Paul O'Neill, who was coming to speak at the end of the day, would not be able to come at any other time. That said, although we know the infection control team really drives this project, the day is really scheduled about putting together teams and initiatives in the intensive care unit. So although it is a conflict, there probably will still be the benefit of different people who have been involved in the project or maybe not involved in the project attending the meeting. And then Mr. O'Neill will be meeting with your CEOs the next day. And we want to try to keep that link together between the teams and the CEOs, that it's rather close, so that the CEOs can, again, be educated about the projects and quality initiatives and be kept in the loop and support you as needed, because quality is needing more and more support and resources in each of the hospitals. That said, I'm just going to introduce Hillary Jalon, and I'm also here with Brian Taylor, see if they have anything to add to this. Hillary and Brian are tracking the receipt of the data and all of the monthly reports. Today is the 20th, so monthly reports are due. Tomorrow, Hillary and Brian will be putting together a list of hospitals who have submitted baseline data and then the May, June, and July data. And we will be emailing that out to everyone. At this point, we would like to try to get all of the data issues resolved, that we have at least the baseline data from everyone and 3 months' worth of data, so that we can begin sending out aggregate reports to you so you see where you stand, what improvements you've made, and how you stand in comparison to the other participating hospitals, and then we can group it by peer groupings, teaching versus non-teaching hospitals. And keep in mind that the data will be kept confidential. Lastly, we did put together a data agreement form. I know it's coming after the fact, but we do want to maintain the confidentiality of your data. So the project leads will be getting a copy of that data agreement form if you have not already received it. We just ask that it be sent back to us, and then we'll send you a copy. Basically, it's just saying that Greater New York and United Hospital Fund will maintain the data, maintain the integrity and confidentiality of the data, and we will not share or sell or do anything with that data without your permission. And this data then is also protected under the New York State Quality Act, so that it's protected data under quality. So I'm finished, and I'd like to just see, Hillary, do you have anything to add?
No, the only thing that I wanted to say, we were developing a homepage for the Jenny website, which we've heard some comments that it's a little difficult to get around. It's almost complete, and we'll be piloting and getting suggestions from you for improving it.
Okay. At this point, Dr. Shannon, just so you're aware, I'm not sure if you have the agenda, but I believe Hillary did send it. The Mount Sinai team will be speaking for 10 minutes and then or 15 minutes, and then we'll roll over into your discussion. And thanks again for giving us your time. We're honored.
Sure.
Lori?
Okay. My name is Lori Finkelstein-Blonde. I'm the Director of Performance Improvement here at Mount Sinai, and I'm just going to, for those of you who may have downloaded our slides, take you through the slide set to give you a little a feel for what we're doing at Mount Sinai. Some of our vital statistics, we're a very busy hospital, 970-bed tertiary care teaching facility in Manhattan. We have approximately 51,000 discharges per year. We have 8 critical care units, MICU, SICU, neurosurgical, CCU, CTICU, NICU, PICU, and a CTS step-down unit. In addition, we also have a respiratory care unit. There is an estimated 3,000-plus central lines that are placed here annually. The largest number of lines are placed probably by the line service and the surgical intensive care unit. The goals of our project, when we started out, based on the AIMS, et cetera, was to eliminate central line catheter-associated bloodstream infections. We are intending to implement them and implement that and monitor the PDSA reduction strategies that we're implementing. We're going to demonstrate reliable use of the central line bundle and consistent reductions in infection rates. The goal of our project here, too, is to expand participation to all critical care areas within the hospital. As you could see by the next slide, it is really a multidisciplinary approach, and the coordination really is extensive to get all the players involved and keep them involved. If you go to the next slide, for the purposes of the project, we picked 2 of our busy ICUs, the medical intensive care unit, 14 beds with an 85% average daily census capacity, our surgical ICU, also 14 beds with an average daily census of 91%. You can see we're busy. Our objectives in May were to introduce the project to the clinical staff, to implement standardized CVC dressing change kits and chlorhexidine hospital-wide, and that was actually ready to be implemented the day that we went to the kickoff meeting. We had been working on that, our critical care committee and our infection control people, for almost, I would say, and materials management for 9 months prior to the onset of that. So that was a lengthy process to get everything ready to roll out. So we really, at that point, wanted to begin assuring the availability of the maximum sterile barriers and dressing kits and really push out the understanding regarding the standardized protocols and maintenance. We began developing the daily goals and refining the infection prevention checklist, developing and rolling out an education plan. We decided we were going to participate in the CLABS component of the 100,000 Lives campaign. So that was May. So come June, we started with the help of Dr. Deb Marin. She was called away for the moment, but she's our chief medical officer, weekly multidisciplinary meetings, which I think was really very instrumental in helping this project move forward. Having that leadership with us. We joined the 100,000 Lives campaign, and we started implementation of the PDSA cycles. We developed and started implementing the daily goal sheets in multidisciplinary rounds in the ICUs. The infection prevention checklists were also implemented. We began skills validations and retraining. There was a catheter maintenance checklist developed. The group decided we wanted a blood culture log and bedside root cause analysis, sort of like sheet, that could help guide caregivers through a mini bedside root cause analysis when there was a positive culture. We did recognize that there was diversification that needed to be addressed on each unit and that we couldn't expect everything to be standard, that units were different and they all had their own culture and personality. We put our heads together to create some type of a banner to highlight the number of days per each month each unit would go without an infection, and thinking that that would also involve the staff and get them excited about the project that they were participating in. In addition, we began performance improvements rounds, which included the participation of the chief medical officer to go up to the units and actually participate in these multidisciplinary rounds, see what was going on, provide some feedback, also help the understand how the units were dealing with the issues. I mentioned it before, but just to emphasize that the standardization of the protocols which we sent out was very labor-intensive, and really credit needs to go to the critical care committee that's actually chaired here by Dr. Benjamin, who's the director of the surgical ICU, and participation by Dr. Nierman, who's here, and Dr. Calfee, who actually pushed this through in terms of the standardization of the protocol. It then had to go through the nursing practice committees to make sure that everything was consistent with nursing practice. It went through the nursing executive committee, the infection control committee, and up ultimately to the medical board. The additional CLABS PDSA-related materials that we sent out to you were actually developed as part of these weekly work meetings that we were having. And it's an ongoing refinement of the forms and the tools as we think that we can improve upon them. So, you know, for as quickly as, you know, we start working on something, you know, we may during the study or testing phase, if you will, realize that we can improve upon it a little more and make some changes here and there. In terms of the education and collaboration, there is extensive preparation that's going on with regard to the physician training, being able to explain to the physicians and validate and demonstrate the intent of the central line protocol, and there's planned participation by all our critical care physicians. Attendings will be informed, house staff, critical care fellows, and rotating house staff. We've collaborated with the Department of Anesthesia, purchased 2 SICU and MICU mannequins so that there can be a simulated practicum that's created. And I don't know, David, do you want to mention something about the the development of the education at this point? Okay. All right. In terms of the collaboration and education with regard to nursing, there was a skills checklist validation form that was created. And actually, the nurses have, as you can see by the slide on page 5, well, I don't know, depending on how you print it out, but 92% of the nurses in the SICU were trained in the central line protocol, 95% in the dressing change kit, 85% in the SICU received general education regarding the project and the reduction strategies. In terms of the MICU, 100% of the nursing staff received general education, dressing change skills validation, 77.1% of the staff, and the central line protocol, 100%. So there's been a tremendous effort by nursing and nursing education to make sure the nurses are ready to take on the role. In terms of the overall challenges of the project, just the coordination is a big deal. Reaching consensus and accepting diversity between different units and different people. Coordination of the physician retraining and validation. The delays were due to the intended selection and the purchase of the simulator mannequins, and the timing of the orientation of the new house staff actually made it a little bit more difficult. Availability of the RNs to be at the bedside at time of central line insertion is something that we're continuing to struggle with, and we're actually looking at systems relating to why that's an issue. In terms of next steps, our infection control department will continue to do the surveillance and collect the the line days and the do the infection surveillance and provide the feedback with regard to that. There's also ongoing performance improvement monitoring and provision of feedback that's as a result of our rounds. We intend to post this banner that you have a sample of in the conference areas of each of our participating ICUs. We did want it to be inconspicuous, not in a patient care area. Also, we've begun training in the emergency department, and that's physician training. At this point, we'll need to move on to the nursing training as well there to continue to refine forms as necessary to start to collect with, and analyze our PDSA data. And actually, that's another challenge in terms of the data collection and the analysis process. And then we've been working on that and trying to figure that out, whether or not to do it centrally or locally. And I think we're probably going to go with centrally so as not to burden the staff in the units. To acknowledge and reward staff, our weekly meetings, we try to think about incentives for people that are doing a good job. And as I said in the very beginning, to expand the project to all our ICUs. On the next page is a sample of our banner that we're considering. There are various banners for various units, and we took some pictures and pulled some pictures off the internet and so that we can make it more, you know, lifelike. That's about it. We continue to work. We continue to meet. It is a lot of work, but I think we're all enjoying it and finding that the experience is a good one, especially when we see our rates go down.
Great presentation, Lori. You guys are doing a tremendous amount of work. Operator, do you want to open it up for questions now? We'll take two or three questions, Lori.
Okay.
Dr. Shannon's presentation.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question at this time, please press the 1 key on your touch-tone telephone. If your question has been answered or you wish to remove yourself from the queue, please press the pound key. Again, if you would like to ask a question, please press the 1 key now. At this time, I'm showing no questions. Again, if you have a question, please press 1 now. And there are no questions.
Great. Thank you so much, Mount Sinai. That's phenomenal. You're doing a great job on this. And we really appreciate you being the first out the door to give a presentation, especially when we have Dr. Shannon on the line.
Terry, let me this is Rick Shannon. Let me just say, you know, in listening to the presentation, it seems to me that Mount Sinai has accomplished in the couple of months since I've been in New York what it's taken us here 2 years to do. And that's incredibly gratifying to me, you know, to see that, in fact, when an organization committed to this effort, they can really get up and running and put into place the multiple elements of work. I mean, we really did it incrementally, and I think if places like Mount Sinai, and I'm sure there are others in your consortium, are able to do this with this degree of alacrity, it's really going to result in monumental beneficial outcomes. Really terrific.
Thank you.
It's great. Well, Lori, I'm sure many of us will be calling you for some advice on all of this, and it's very interesting that you have the simulation models to do this. Do they get a certificate after they're done with that simulation training?
Dr. Benjamin's going to answer that question.
No, we don't, because we believe that outside of clubs, there are some other safety-related issues, and we cannot certify. We can certify somebody is compliant with clubs. We cannot certify that person is going to be very safe to place online at all time of the day and night. So we don't certify anybody.
So it's not a formal certification program?
No. At the end of the fellowship, yes.
Okay. Well, thank you again. At this time, I'd like to introduce Dr. Richard Shannon, who's the chairman of the Department of Medicine at Allegheny General Hospital. And I think we're all familiar with Dr. Shannon at this point. We see your face up on our Jenny website, Dr. Shannon. And I think hospitals have found it very useful to go back and review that. And it's a great teaching tool. So, Dr. Shannon.
So you want me to go through that presentation? Or do you want me to just talk a little bit about the three things that we've discussed, namely the bile patch, the IRR, and the subclavian versus IJ?
If you could just start touching on those three bulleted items, and then we'll go into your presentation on return on investment.
Okay, the bulleted items in the website.
Right, the jugular versus subclavian.
Okay, good. Several questions have come up that Terry and Hillary asked me to speak to specifically. The first is we mentioned in our training module that we are training people in the techniques for both the subclavian and the internal jugular. And one question was that seems a bit contradictory, as we state and the CDC and others have stated that the subclavian is the preferred site. I think there's no question the subclavian is the preferred site with respect to reducing the risk of central line associated bloodstream infections. But in our units, as I imagine is true of many of your units, access is a precious commodity. And under many circumstances, we find that the subclavians have either already been used, say with a pacemaker or a defibrillator, or are planned to be used. And one of the groups in our place that jealously guard that access are the nephrologists. So while we believe it's the preferred site, there may be circumstances in our case, and I'm sure in yours, where an alternative site is required. And so the internal jugular approach is taught, although we urge people to use the subclavian site if it's available. So I don't really think it's so much inconsistent as it reflects the complexity of care that I think we have and I'm sure many of you have in your ICUs. So in our training module, we train people to put in both subclavians and to put in internal jugular catheters. It's really the femorals that we're trying to discourage completely by asking people to, if they need to use femoral access, to remove it within 12 hours to avoid the risk of infection. So my view, and it sounds like in the Mount Sinai experience, that what our goal is to really train people in better techniques around placing lines. We do that for both the subclavian and the IJ. While we urge the subclavian, sometimes the IJ is the best you're going to get. So that's the reason we include it. I think the second question had to do with the bile patch. And as I mentioned when I was in New York, during our first year of work on central line associated bloodstream infections, we really focused on standardizing the practices for placing lines and standardizing the way in which our nurses cared for the lines. And that was associated with a substantial reduction in central line infections from 49 to 6. But we still had 6 infections. And what we learned from that experience was that we the infections were really occurring in patients who had to have catheters in for a prolonged period of time, where either access was limited or, as in the case of a temporary dialysis catheter, it might take 6 or 8 weeks before their fistula would mature. And that was the group that we were still continuing to have a risk of infections. To address that, we adopted the practice of using the bile patch in what we call high-risk circumstances. Now, high risk in our case is defined by the following criteria. And again, these are based upon our observations in our units, and yours might be a little bit different, but this is the way we went about thinking about it. First, anybody with a temporary dialysis catheter, what we call VASCath, but what you may call something else, anybody that needs acute dialysis who doesn't have a fistula and gets a line placed gets a bile patch. And that's because in our dialysis patient population, we had a high risk of catheter-related bacteremias. Incidentally, endocarditis following catheter-related bacteremias tends to be very common in these dialysis patients, largely because of the associated calcifications of their heart valves. So we put bile patches on all of our temporary dialysis catheters. Secondly, we put bile patches on all of our PICC lines. And again, this is because at least in our circumstance, the concept of using a peripherally inserted central catheter is because the administration of an antibiotic or a TPN or whatever is going to be for a prolonged period of time. And it is desirable to have that line in place for a long period of time. So by virtue of the chronic indwelling nature of that catheter, we define that as high risk, and a bile patch goes on all PICC lines. The third group is, again, defined based upon our observations, which is anybody with a subclavian or an IJ catheter who the line has been in for 7 days and it is anticipated going to need to stay in, on day 7 we place a bile patch. So we don't give every central line a bile patch, but a central line that's been in place for 7 days and needs to stay in place, as occurs in our case in these patients with limited access, we then define that as a high-risk line and put a bile patch on it. And that's all determined by nursing in discussion with the residents on rounds in the morning. So each day we ask the question, do they need the line? If the line's been in for 7 days and it's anticipated they're going to continue to need it, we put a bile patch on. Now, things have evolved since then. There's one more circumstance in which we've decided to use the bile patch, and that is, again, in circumstances in which there's limited access and someone does have a femoral line and it has to stay in. So we had a guy that had a fistula in his right arm that wasn't working, had a maturing fistula in his left arm, and everybody was really nervous about using his veins in his upper body, so he had a femoral line in place. We couldn't easily take it out until we got a PICC line in. So because the femoral was in for longer than 12 hours, we put a bile patch on it. So those are the circumstances. Again, I don't have hard data to document the specifics of those, but it gives you an idea about at least the thinking that we went through in this regard. The final series of questions actually had to do with the business case that we've made around central line-associated bloodstream infections. And many of you who have seen or have viewed my presentation will note that the economic analysis comes towards the end, and that we found in our institution that we were losing about $1.2 million a year in loss from operations related to central line associated bloodstream infections. That's based upon 72 infections in all of our ICUs. We went back and asked the question, what was the investment required to reduce central line infections in the MICU and CCU from 49 to 6? And just to quantitate this, in fiscal year 03, we lost nearly $1 million from operations in the CCU and MICU alone, with each central line infection losing about $19,000. And we had 49 infections, so that's the math. We were losing about $19,000 per central line infection, close to $1 million in the course of the year in the CCU and MICU alone. When we reduced the number of infections to 6, the actual loss from operations attributable to the CLABS in that year was $85,000. So we basically reduced the loss from operations by about $900,000 over the course of that year. The average central line infection in fiscal year 04, we lost $14,000 per case, but we only had 6, so we had a dramatic reduction in the loss from operations. And, of course, the question is, what did we have to invest? We, as I may have told you in my presentation, bought a Sonosite machine, which is an ultrasound device which can be used to identify and place with greater fidelity central catheters as opposed to using traditional landmark procedures, and that cost $10,000. And then we put a bio patch on, which cost $5 in the selected circumstances. And then we invested in the chlorhexidine for our dressing change kits. The aggregate investment in the year in which we attained our results was $25,000, or $24.15 per case. So we returned $900,000 on the investment of $25,000, which by my very unsophisticated math is an IRR of about 34 times. So the investment in terms of capital and new equipment and procedures was $25K. The return on investment was about $900K. And that's data that we're now trying to organize to submit for publication so that this question of how much does it cost to get the investment back can be answered definitively. So those are the three bullet points. Maybe we should stop here and ask for some questions.
Hey, operator, if you'd like, you could open the lines.
Again, ladies and gentlemen, if you have a question, please press the 1 key. The first question comes from Allison Scaduto from Greater New York Hospital.
Hi, Dr. Shannon.
Hi.
I was wondering, what is the extra benefit of the bile patch? I've met with a couple of vendors, and, you know, they give conflicting stories about, you know, there was one person who came in with a silver patch.
Yeah.
And I was just, you know, wondering if the site is being cleansed with ChloraPrep, what is the extra benefit of the BioSite?
Yeah, I don't know if you're using the ChloraPrep, what the extra benefit is. Here's what we observed.
Okay.
We observed that when the lines are in place for a long period of time, that there is frequently the chance that, particularly over weeks, that as the dressings are changed and stuff like that, that skin contaminants could give rise to our infections. And in those six infections that we had, they were all with coag negative staph.
Okay.
So we reasoned that these were skin contaminants, and that what we could infer from the literature and what's been published about BioPatch, it was particularly good at trying to disinfect the area of insertion. And the way the BioPatch is designed, it sort of has a neck that kind of can hook around the catheter insertion site, which to our mind seemed like a reasonable idea.
Mm-hmm.
That there may be other ways to do it, I think, are perfectly reasonable to consider. This was just an easy, self-contained way that we tried. So that's really the issue. It was based upon the fact that we had mostly coag-negative staph and these chronically indwelling lines, and we thought if we added this extra precaution, we could reduce that skin contaminant.
Mm-hmm, okay.
We've not compared it to something else.
Okay.
The next question comes from Virginia Verde from St. Catherine.
Hi, Dr. Shannon. We have two questions. The first one is, do you recommend that we use the BioPatch for porticaths?
Tell me what you mean by porticath. Everybody kind of uses different terms.
Porticath is an implanted port, and we're wondering, should we use the BioPatch underneath the Huber needle when it's in place?
Yeah, I don't have any experience with it. I know what you mean now, but we have not used the BioPatch under that circumstance. So I'm not so sure how to advise you.
And the second question is, what is the rationale for not placing the BioPatch at the initial insertion of the catheter?
Well, good question. And I think that you could certainly make the argument to do it. It is a $5 additional cost, and we were pretty confident if we adhered to our specified work design that most of our lines would be out in a relatively short period of time. So we decided that our initial work redesign would deal with the first 7 days of risk, and that lines in longer than that really constituted the ones we were trying to target. So I think if you've got good line maintenance guidelines, and it sounds like, you know, some of the work being done by the nurses at Mount Sinai, and I'm sure at your place, would involve those guidelines, it may not be necessary to do in the first 7 days. But again, I can't say we've tested that in some hypothesis-driven way. I know there are other centers that are using them on all of their lines. Much like Mount Sinai, we're looking at, you know, 3,000 lines as an institution a year, close to 1,100 lines just in the CCU and MICU alone. So we weren't confident that we needed them on all of them. For example, the cardiac surgery units, people get their Swan-Ganz put in the OR, and they come out, and the next day it comes out. Do we really need a BioPatch for that? So that's the reason we decided not to use it on every line, but to rather make the clinical decision. It does one other thing for us, and this is kind of the TPS way, the Toyota way of thinking of it. It signals to the team that we have a high-risk circumstance, and it allows us to increase our observations and precautions around the line. So that's kind of a vague response, but that's how we decided to do it the way we did.
Okay. And I actually have one more question. Sorry. What percentage of your lines were discontinued before 7 days? Do you know that?
Let me just look. Hold on. That's a great question. In the medical ICU and CCU in fiscal year 03, it looks like 54% of our lines were discontinued within 7 days.
Okay. Yeah.
So a little less than half went longer. I can't tell you how long, though. I don't have that data in front of me.
Okay.
But we, you know, again, I think that your individual circumstances will govern this, but as you get sicker and sicker patients in your ICUs and particularly, let me give you the most recent example. You know, we're doing a lot of bariatric surgical procedures here, and in these very in these morbidly obese patients, the one access you get may be the only access you get, and some of them require it for a considerable period of time postoperatively. So that would be an illustration of a case where we're trying to identify high-risk circumstances and treat them with the additional added protection of a bio patch.
Okay, thank you.
The next question comes from Christine Parks from Lenox Hill Hospital.
Yeah, hi, Gerald Barr, Lenox Hill Hospital, Dr. Shannon.
Hi.
Hi. We were wondering about the DVD or video training tool that you had spoken when you had given the original presentation.
Right.
Is that available?
Yeah. So the let me tell you that it's really our training module is really a three-part exercise. The first part is a didactic, which is a PowerPoint presentation of about 50 or 60 images that goes through issues around line placement and maintenance, the basics of anatomy and things like that. We also have a post-didactic session test, a 20-question exam that we have our residents complete, and they have to get 18 of the 20 questions right after they complete the module. The second part is a video, which really films the perfect line placement and maintenance. And we've done this, but it's in the process of editing, and we haven't yet figured out internally how to get that available on our website. So that part you won't be able to access. I can either send you the didactic presentation or we can give you the link to get it from AGH. The third part is the practical part. And again, the folks at Sinai were talking a little bit about this. We've purchased mannequins of the neck and the thorax, and actually now we've gotten forearm mannequins so that people can come into what we call the simulation center and demonstrate they know how to go through a pre-procedure checklist, how to gown and glove, how to drape and prep, how to pick the right catheter, and then how to insert it. So that part's hard to capture for you. So the part that's easily accessible is the didactic. We will have the filming part available, but I don't know how soon we can get it up on our website. And the didactic part, or I'm sorry, the practical part is something that, you know, I think would be hard to share unless you came here or eventually went to Mount Sinai and saw how theirs is doing. So those are the three parts. But I can get you, if you want to email me, which is probably the easiest way, then I can just attach the PowerPoint presentation, and you can use that as well as the test.
I think my
email is rshannon.
I think the PowerPoint presentation is up on the website. We were interested. Obviously, it's not ready yet, the actual DVD or video part.
Yeah, we haven't gotten that part live yet. We have filmed it, but there were some, you know, I'm not a video guy, but there were some issues they wanted to correct, and we haven't gotten that one up yet. But as soon as we do, I'm happy to share it.
Thank you.
At this time, I'm showing no further questions. Again, if you have a question, please press the 1 key. The next question comes from Kathleen Riley.
I think we can just talk. This is Josie Padrone and Kathleen Riley at Wyckoff Heights Medical Center. We wanted to ask you, Dr. Shannon, if you could please describe the system used at Allegheny Hospital for getting that bio patch on the patient. Is there an MD order written for each patient? Is there a standing order? Are the nurses permitted to use their own judgment? Could you describe that?
This is the nurses are permitted to use their own judgment. So obviously we've all agreed in our collaborative that if it's a dialysis catheter or a PICC line, they automatically get a bio patch. And then since the nurses round with the team every morning, if the patient has a central line, the nurse will ask, this is day 7, do you think it's going to be in for a long period of time? The house officer or the attending physician will say yes, and then the nurse will apply the bio patch. So it's really the nurses. We don't have standing orders, nor do we require an order to do it.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
We have a question from Mount Sinai.
Okay, great.
Dr. Nierman?
Yeah, hi, this is Dave Nierman, the medical ICU director here.
Hi, Dave.
I've got a question about your financial evaluation of the cost of CLABS. A lot of our debate and discussion here has been about the people involved in both attending the line placement, collecting data, entering data, doing analysis, et cetera, et cetera. And it strikes me that that really is the biggest cost of all this.
Yeah.
Have you actually calculated that out to determine what that is?
That's an excellent question. What about time? Let me try and take it in three parts, Dave, because I do think this is important. Let me begin by saying that we incurred no additional personnel cost. We didn't hire anybody. We didn't reassign someone to this project when we began. We freed up my time, and I may have mentioned this in my presentation, but the time that we did free up for me was created by me being excused from hospital meetings in which these issues were being discussed, but nothing was being done. So on average, I was able to free up 4 hours of time a week from what I would call meetings where we went and talked about this stuff and didn't do anything about it. And I used those 4 hours to spend in the ICUs helping people solve problems and overcoming barriers to getting their work done. So 4 hours of my time, but it would have been I would say it was time that was that I would have spent here anyway and was simply redirected away from, you know, quality management meetings and special meetings to discuss this and that, that I basically didn't go to. It was about 4 hours a week. So the second issue about time was that by standardizing the way in which our nurses and our residents and fellows did their work, by that I mean having kits available where they didn't have to go hunting for all the equipment to put in a central line, establishing and creating a dressing kit that was always available on the unit so nurses didn't have to go find parts of the kit all the time. We actually estimated that in any given procedure, we saved anywhere from 20 to 30 minutes of physician time and as much as 20, 30 minutes of nursing time between all the things they ran around doing because none of the work was standardized. So we have taken that time in shortening these procedures and translated that into the process for examining in real time a CLAB when it occurs. So again, we didn't add work. We simply took what I would call valueless work and created value from it by defining the way in which the work should be done so and providing people with what they needed to do the work. The part that I think has not been quantitated that's a good point is the training. So now that we are doing this training module, the whole thing takes about 4 hours, and we are training all of our fellows and all of our residents, and we've completed that task for the critical care areas so far. But the nursing training does take time, and our module is an interdisciplinary module where the practical part, which really takes about 2 hours to do it right, to train in all the elements of it, the practical part, we've had to negotiate with our nursing service to free up the time for our nurses to be trained. So 2 hours times 60 nurses times whatever your nursing rate is would now be a new cost in this fiscal year of the training module. And that will have to be added over time. But I would argue we'll back out of the financial analysis the $10,000 capital investment in the Sonosite because that's a one-time investment, and the operating costs of running that are pretty minimal, just the sterile sleeve that comes with it. So we'll have to recalculate based upon the training module time. But I think to get started does not require adding personnel and does not require freeing people up. If you don't, the data coordination was already being done in our case by the infection control personnel. It's just that now it was done in real time as opposed to retrospectively. So I think time is important to quantitate, and it may be different in other institutions than in ours. And I think we do have the clock running now on our training module with respect to nurses' times. And I will tell you, finally, that Allegheny General Hospital's Board of Trustees, based upon this work this year, beginning July 1, gave us a $1.5 million line item for quality to begin to hire more people and to begin to train more individuals going forward. So that's the good, the bad, and the ugly. At the start, we didn't have much, but as we've proven our results and demonstrated the economic benefit to the institution, we now have a $1.5 million line item just for quality initiatives.
Thank you.
We have another question from Sinai, from Dr. Benjamin.
Hi, Dr. Shannon. How are you?
Good, thanks.
I have one question and one comment. The question is, what is your nursing staffing, and do you have a nursing charge for when, for example, there are not enough nurses because they are running to Catskill and elsewhere? Who covers in the meantime? And the and the comment has to do with the slides that I look at. One point in particular got my attention, where it is said that the dilator has to be inserted all the way to the hub. We've published that people can die from that.
Yes, I know. First of all, the issue of the charge nurses. In both the MICU and the CCU, each shift we have a charge nurse. And nominally that person is supposed to be engaged in problem solving around issues such as central line associated bloodstream infections and to assist where necessary in the care of patients with these issues. So the charge nurse is responsible for making sure that the documentation about the line status is up to date at the bedside, to answer issues that a nurse might have about whether a site looks indurated or whether the weeping should require that the line be replaced. So ideally, the charge nurse is involved in seeing to it that problems are solved around these initiatives on a daily basis. The reality is that about 50% of the time, the charge nurse gets pulled into some staffing-related thing. And this obviously erodes the help chain for our nurses on the line and creates a big problem, particularly under circumstances in which we have a lot of new nurses. So the first part of the question is, we have a charge nurse. I would say she functions in the capacity of really being a guardian of these safety initiatives only about 50% of the time. I'm sorry Joy or Julie aren't here to comment on that more, but the reality is they do get pressed into patient services. With respect to what we put on the module about dilators, we're keenly aware that there are data to suggest that putting the dilator in all the way may constitute a risk. And, you know, there's a lot of feedback we're getting from that module now. I don't want to leave you with the impression that we're the perfect line placement issue, but this is a first generation of it. I take your comments with great seriousness, and you should know it's one of the issues we're talking about modulating right now, because I don't think you need to jam that thing all the way in to be able to get your introducer in place. So I completely agree with you. But bear in mind, you know, that these are all works in progress, and I think each of you will find this. One of the biggest issues that I've learned in this course of this work is you're never done. You never have it quite right. And, in fact, the more you kind of tweak the system once you get it in place, the more likely you are to continue your progress toward excellence. But your comments are right on the mark. We've noted that. Many people have commented on it, and I think we're going to fix it.
I fully agree with you. I just don't want some people that are away from bedside to think that this is – coming from God, and that's the way you have to do it.
You know, and this is another really important point, particularly since we have critical care physicians on the line. You know, I'm a cardiologist, but I'm sort of a chairman of medicine, and I would highly doubt that I would qualify as a critical care doctor today. Critical care medicine has really become an extraordinary specialty, and I think we need to really look to folks like yourselves running big critical care areas like this, to really help shape some of these modules. I was just out in Madison, Wisconsin, and the critical care folks at the University of Wisconsin are really taking a major lead in trying to refine some of these things. So, listen, please don't take what we put there as perfect. I think that by sharing this information, we hope to get this kind of feedback and to really end up with something that's perfect. And that's the advantage of a collaborative, guys, because one guy might be doing it one way, and yet they might see and learn from another hospital or group a different or better way to do it. But in the end, it takes a long time before you find the perfect way.
Thank you very much. If only I could use your comments to get charge nurses at Sinai, I will accomplish a lot.
Yeah. I think these are all ongoing challenges for all of us. But I can tell you, when the administration begins to feel and relate the savings associated with the reduction in these infections to the work that your nurses are doing, it becomes a lot easier to find a charge nurse that's freed up.
Thank you, Dr. Shannon.
Sure.
I'm showing no further questions. I'm showing no further questions.
Terry, I don't know if there's something else you want me to do. I think that's been a pretty good discussion.
Yes, you can talk to the CFOs of the different participating hospitals, tell them that they can save a lot by investing a little.
That's a message that took a while to sink in here, but I think is now pretty much etched in the fabric of the place. When we have a month at AGH now where we don't make budget, you know, where we're off plan, the CFO calls me and says, you know, is there something going on with these infections, Dr. Shannon? So we've gotten her attention. But listen, I really think this is the opportunity on October 19th when Paul O'Neill comes, where hopefully the leaderships of your systems or their representatives will be at that meeting. This is a real opportunity to capture their imagination. You know, Paul O'Neill is the former Secretary of the Treasury. He knows something about numbers. And if the CFOs are going to believe anybody, it's going to be another numbers person. So I would really urge the extent that you can to try and get your leadership to that session, because I think if anybody can convince them, it's another, you know, bean counter like the former Secretary of the Treasury.
Well, Dr. Shannon, another great job. We really appreciate you participating in this call. And we'll share this information with those that were not able to make the call today.
Great.
Before we close, operator, I just want to double check that there's no further questions.
We do have Grace Langen from Lutheran Medical Center.
Hey, Grace.
Yeah, hi, Dr. Shannon.
Yes.
Maintenance is the majority of the problems, 85%. I think you said 84%.
I'm sorry, say again?
Maintenance is the problem about 85% of the time, right?
That was our experience, yes.
What is your special protocol with maintenance? Do you change the end caps? How often? Do you wipe with chlorhexidine or alcohol?
Excellent questions. So the nursing-specific activities with respect to this now require that the hubs be wiped with chlorhexidine, not alcohol. We change the caps every day. Every day. I'm sorry Joy and Julie aren't here, but we have really tried to drill down hard on the maintenance issues because we think that it's breaches in those processes that, in our experience, lead to these catheter infections and these long indwelling catheters. But it's true, about 80 or 85% of our lines that become infected today become infected in what I would call a more chronic period. But I apologize I don't have this, but we have pretty much specified that we change the caps every day. We use the chlorhexidine wipes on the caps. The dressings are changed every 7 days, except if there's weeping or erythema that we see. Just trying to think about other specifications.
Do your residents touch the lines for blood, or only the nurses are allowed to do that?
Only the nurses are allowed to touch the lines.
You have a checklist for the nurses when they run through, or that's just on an honor system?
No, excellent question. So we did not have a checklist initially, and this is very important, and you know, I think that in the presentation from Mount Sinai, we kind of heard some of this. So we just assumed that if we told people what to do, they would do it, right? But the reality is when we went back and did audits, even in a unit like ours where people are really well-intended and they're all fired up about this, as it turns out, a nurse will do any one of these things with a great degree of fidelity. So in any given case, a nurse will change the caps every day 100% of the time. But if you look at the five or six activities around line maintenance, we only do all five or six about all together, every one of them, in about 40% of the lines. So in other words, we do four out of five, or we do three out of five, or we do five out of six. But we aren't really good at doing all of the things we say we're going to do around that maintenance. And one of the things that's caused us to consider is that we haven't really figured out yet a way to make these things a natural part of a nurse's work. And we came upon this because I said to the nurses, listen, tell me one thing you would never forget to do. And this I found astonishing. The nurses said to me, oh, we always check residuals on NG tubes. I said, what are you talking about? Why would you check the residual and never forget to check the residual? Oh, Dr. Shannon, we all learn in nursing school that, you know, if the person's got a residual, they're at risk for aspirating. I said, well, that's good. How do you embed that kind of thing in the work? So that's what our audits have allowed us to do, to see that we do any one thing frequently, but we don't do all of the things in our bundle with that great frequency. So we're really trying to look at that work to figure out how to do it right. Because what I think we have to avoid is generating lists of things for people to do, nurses to do, and not understand the implications of that for their work. And we haven't solved that problem yet. Don't get me wrong, but I think that it's a key to making this stuff sustainable.
Dr. Shannon?
Yeah.
And I just want to comment. It's Lori from Mount Sinai, and Evelyn Nunez is here. She's a nurse manager in our surgical ICU. She and Maxine Shepherd, who's a nurse manager in our medical ICU, they came up with a catheter maintenance checklist. We didn't include that because we're still working on it.
Yeah.
But one of the intentions of that is so that the nurses can actually see whether or not all things have been done.
Right.
So for the line and properly. And when we have to do a mini root cause or bedside root cause, we're going to include looking at the catheter insertion checklist, the catheter maintenance checklist, as well as the physician procedure note to see as much as possible, you know, what kinds of things might have been omitted.
Yep. I think that's a great idea. But anything that you can do to try and figure out a way that it's natural for the work to get done as you've specified. Because I think the problem is, particularly early on in this work, and this gets to the question that was asked earlier about time and the value of time, if what we do to our nurses or to our house staff is simply add more work and the value of the work doesn't free up other time for them, it becomes really easy to create what I call priorities. And what priorities do is they mean some things get done, some things don't. And that's not what you want to do in a perfect world. What you want to create is what Paul O'Neill calls preconditions, and that for the work to be done, these are the things that we have in place. And really, that's what we're trying to do in our work redesign, and it sounds like some of the visual clues that you're developing at Mount Sinai are designed to do that. But it's a challenge, and this is what's really difficult about the work, is that these sorts of issues come up continuously, and you really have to be creative at each turn to figure out what's the way to deal with it. But the value of time to professionals such as nurses, given all the things we ask of them to do, is really important. Our approach has been to try and do away with value-less work, running around trying to find things that they ought to have readily available to do their work, as a way to free them up and allow them to do more value-added work.
All right, great. Well, we can't thank you enough, and Lori and the other folks at Mount Sinai, again, thank you again for sharing. And for the next call, we'll certainly be reaching out to others to give the same type of presentation that Lori just gave. And in the meantime, Greater New York will be reaching out to you and UHF to do some site visits to just look at your process, see how far you progressed, and try to identify any challenges that you're still facing so that we could potentially identify an intervention, a best practice, or a speaker to assist you with moving the project forward. So thank you again for your participation, and we look forward to speaking to you again in 2 weeks.
Bye.
Ladies and gentlemen, that does conclude the conference for today. Again, thank you for your participation. You may all disconnect. Have a good day.